Go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/online-therapy to get 20% off your first month of cognitive behavioural therapy, with weekly sessions online with a therapist, in addition to worksheets, a journal, meditation and yoga videos, and unlimited messaging. There's strong evidence that CBT can help people who hoard, and accessing therapy online can be affordable and accessible. Find out more and get your discount at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/online-therapy.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Now on Broadway, An Enemy of the People is a New York Times critic's pick. Jeremy Strong is one of the great actors of his generation, hails the Chicago Tribune in a performance the Wall Street Journal praises as powerfully affecting and bitterly funny. Michael Imperioli sets off sparks, cheers the Hollywood Reporter. Victoria Pedretti is luminous, raves variety. From director Sam Gold and playwright Amy Herzog, An Enemy of the People is urgent, electrifying, and haunting, declares USA Today. An Enemy of the People on Broadway through June 16th only.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder podcast. I am drowning in stuff and trying to find a way out. Listen as I explore the issues and delve deep as somebody profoundly affected by hoarding disorder. Find out more, including links to subscribe to the podcast and all of my social media at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. Finally, I am not a doctor. I am just a hoarder doing her best. So do seek professional support if and when you need it. Hey, how are you? I am all right. It is pleasantly warm outside and unpleasantly warm inside. So this is coming at you from a house that is currently 34 degrees C. A house that, like every house in this country, is built to keep heat in and not built for these temperatures. And as if 34 degrees C is not enough, I think that's about 95 degrees F, I've had to turn the fan off to record this. So fun times all round. So if I swoon or something partway through, you'll know why. Although, to be honest, if I swoon or something partway through, I'll edit that out. I was going to say because I'm a pro, which I'm blatantly not, but I do my best. So I hope... Yeah, I hope you're having a cheerful day wherever you are listening. I have had a boost of listeners from South Africa. I don't know how that happened, but hi, South Africa. I continue to do inexplicably well in the Bahamas and lately in South Korea. So hi to people in all of those and every place around the world who listens to this. Today, I'm going to talk about decision making and hoarding. A lot of us have ongoing problems making decisions, whether that's because we agonize over decisions and take forever to make them, or whether it's because we're impulsive and don't give decisions enough thought. And I'm going to talk about why decision making is a particular issue for people who hoard, and then I'm going to go through 27 strategies to help you make decisions, to help you make better decisions, and to help you get to a place where you make a decision that you're happy with ultimately. A soundbite you might hear quite often is that clutter is a series of unmade decisions. And there is definitely some truth in that. But it's also not that simple when you're talking about hoarding. I think if you're talking about regular clutter, definitely it's a good way of putting it. But with hoarding, there's more to it. Psychology Today looked into claims that people make, the average person makes 35,000 choices a day. And they were unable to kind of identify what was considered a choice. But if you think of it in terms of things like, shall I put the kettle on now or in 10 minutes? Shall I hit snooze when my alarm goes off? Shall I do my emails first or check social media? All those kind of ongoing, exhausting decisions that we all make from the minute we wake up to the minute we fall asleep. I can kind of believe that 35,000 isn't wildly off course as a guess. And I think with hoarding in particular, we're often a bit scared of, have you heard of the butterfly effect? That whole thing that a flap of a butterfly's wing in one part of the world can cause a typhoon in another part of the world. That kind of something that looks like a tiny decision might end up having massive consequences and in an unpredictable and chaotic and unexpected way. And I wonder whether there's some kind of enhancement of that particular fear with people who hoard, that it's not just a choice about throwing away this particular box. It's all the potential ramifications that feel overwhelming, and it's easier often to not make the decision than it is to make the decision. And so when you look into what decision making is, the kind of processes that our brain goes through to make decisions, it's thought to be a mixture of intuition and rationality, and things like biases and ignorance come into play as well. So there's a lot of factors involved in every decision we make. Some like, oh, the road ahead is closed, I'll turn left here instead, is quite a rational decision. The what do I do with this photo of my grandparents' wedding is a more emotional decision. And there's all kinds of in-betweens as well. So in terms of decision-making and hoarding specifically, I read, I'm not going to lie, a lot of academic papers. And it's really interesting. It's really interesting. So there've been a number of studies that look at decision-making and hoarding. So there was one called Neurobiology and Treatment of Compulsive Hoarding by Sanjaya Saxena, which says that the fear of making the wrong decision about what to keep or what to discard is significant in hoarding. And the result of that fear can be that we get avoidant and avoid having to make those decisions at all. She also reports that studies have found that patients who hoard and have OCD report significantly more difficulty making decisions than controls, which is people who don't have any of the conditions, or than people who have OCD but don't hoard. And then there was a study called Perceived Decision-Making Styles Among Individuals with Obsessive Compulsive and Hoarding Disorders by Jedediah Sayeya et al. And they also mentioned that hoarding disorder is characterized by factors that include things like excessive indecisiveness, avoidance of decisions about discarding and organizing, and decisions to save possessions despite negative consequences. they report that a person with hoarding disorder might spend a long time anxiously mulling over a decision. And I'm sure you can relate to that to some degree. They also report that when speaking to people with OCD or with hoarding disorder, those people self-report a lot of procrastination and indecisiveness. And that people who hoard tend to delay decisions, feel regret after making decisions, and report more fears about decision making. Is this sounding familiar? See, it sounds very familiar to me. And so then they started looking into decision making styles. And I didn't fully know what that was until I read the paper. So decision making styles are stable, trait-like approaches to decision making, which can include ways a person gathers and processes information, considers alternatives, and ultimately makes choices. So it's looking at a kind of almost on a personality level, if somebody's making a decision, how do they go about making that decision? It's more like a characteristic of your personality than any kind of diagnosable condition. And the thing about personality styles is that there aren't an agreed upon group of personality styles that researchers can look at. So there was some work done resulting in the decision-making style inventory that identified three decision-making styles, which were analytical, intuitive, and regret avoidant. But then some other researchers decided on five decision-making styles, which were rational, avoidant, dependent, intuitive, and spontaneous. And then, as if that wasn't enough, some other researchers came up with a nine-factor solution to decision-making styles, including seven decisional styles, which are spontaneous, dependent, vigilant, avoidant, brooding, intuitive, and anxious, and also two decisional self-esteem factors, which is really, really interesting. So as well as being either spontaneous or dependent or any of those things, they also looked at whether somebody's decision-making style was confident and respected. So there's all these different ways of understanding what decision-making styles might be. But basically, with people who hoard, they found that hoarders have low opinions of their decision-making abilities and believed that other people also had low opinions of their decision-making abilities. So this is low decisional self-esteem. And the hoarding and OCD groups they studied had relied less on their intuition than healthy controls did when they were making choices. So essentially, we don't have confidence in our own decisions, so we don't trust our intuition. And while intuition is never 100%, I think we all know that often going against our intuition just feels wrong. And if we don't trust our ability to make decisions, you can see how that could skew the way we ultimately make decisions. And then on top of that, they looked at people with hoarding disorder who report making impulsive, spontaneous decisions, which really matches with this kind of feeling like you're unable to be systematic and deliberate when you're making decisions. There's also an interesting thing, I'm not quite sure of its significance, but it seems worth mentioning, that people with hoarding disorder relied less on others when making decisions than not just the people with OCD, but also the healthy control group. And the researchers wondered whether conflict with others in general, and also especially regarding whether items should be saved or discarded, prompted people who hoard to make decisions on their own. And then I looked at a study by Randy Frost, who may be a familiar name to you, called Indecisiveness and Hoarding. And again, this says that people with hoarding disorder reported more decision-making problems than people who don't hoard. Also, adult children of people who hoard reported more indecisiveness. Decision-making problems correlated with, they say, all the features of hoarding, which is excessive acquisition, difficulty discarding, and clutter and disorganization. On top of all of that is the fact that people who hoard are also more likely to be depressed than your average person, and depression has been linked with, guess what, decision-making problems. So what you're seeing is themes here that look at decision-making and hoarding from different angles, but certain things keep coming up. One is indecisiveness, especially when making choices about whether to keep or discard things. One is that even when we do make decisions, we don't have much confidence in them. We don't really believe in our ability to make those decisions. And also that these problems are exaggerated compared to other groups who have been studied. So then I started looking into categorization. It is often reported in people who hoard that we really, really struggle to categorize things. So there was a study called Categorization and Cognitive Deficits in Compulsive Hoarding by Jessica R. Grisham et al. And they looked at how struggling with categorization contributes to problems organizing. So they say that to categorize things efficiently involves planning, developing strategies for how to best group objects, sustained attention, sufficient impulse control, and decision-making abilities. And all of these skills are needed in order to make a decision about where an object belongs. And if we look at those again, planning, a lot of people who hoard are not great at planning. Strategies for how to best group objects, I've talked before about how I certainly find that very difficult. Sustained attention. This can be a problem in people who hoard, and it can be a problem in people with ADHD who often have hoarding traits, hoarding characteristics. And impulse control, again, something that comes up a lot with hoarding and decision-making abilities. So if you look at how each of those factors is involved in categorization, it suddenly becomes really clear why categorization might be especially hard. But then they looked at indecisiveness, and people with hoarding disorder reported being very indecisive. But when they were given a decision-making task to do as part of the research, it found that they weren't indecisive, they were fine. And this is a theme that comes up in a few of the studies I've read. We say that we're bad at making decisions, and then in study conditions, we make decisions in a completely normal way. And another study called The Profile of Executive Function in OCD Hoarders and Hoarding Disorder by Sharon Moraine, who you may remember from a previous episode on ADHD and hoarding, that also found that in structured decision-making situations, hoarders were unimpaired. That means that our decision-making abilities were fine. And this seems at first glance strange, doesn't it? It seems are consistently self-reporting that we struggle with making decisions, but then when we're tested, we're fine at making decisions. And this has come up in, you know, numerous studies. It's not one aberration. And I will list all of these studies in the show notes in case you too want to be diving into complex PDFs on a weekend. And so that question of why we think we're bad at it, but then we're fine at it. Finally, some researchers thought, oh, I wonder if the issue is not so much in making decisions in general, but the issue is in making decisions regarding our possessions or regarding acquisitions, that kind of where emotion comes into play, that in a laboratory setting, we can make a decision about which card to choose or that kind of thing, because there's no emotional investment in the situation. But when you add emotional investment to the situation, is that where our decision making becomes impaired and flawed? And there were two studies, One was called An Exploratory Study of the Neural Mechanisms of Decision-Making in Compulsive Hoarders, and the other was called Neural Mechanisms of Decision-Making in Hoarding Disorder. So they both kind of looked at similar topics, and I'm not even going to try to explain the brain aspects of things, precisely what lit up on a scan, because I do not understand that. And as soon as I start reading about different regions of the brain, it's like, yeah, my eyes glaze over. I don't understand that. But what I do understand is the meaning of the different things they were talking about. So what both of these found is that there are differences in making decisions or categorizing our own stuff compared to making more neutral decisions or decisions about other people's stuff. So one study found that we struggle to categorize our things, but when sorting objects that belong to other people, there was no difficulty at all. And then there was this big study, relatively, where people were put in a scanner and they were shown, they'd brought some pieces of paper from home and they were shown one after the other, either a piece of paper that they'd brought from their own home or a piece of paper that the researcher had brought from their home. And they were shown a piece of paper one at a time and had to decide whether it should be kept or discarded. And if they said it would be discarded, it was shredded there and then in the lab. So it was a committed decision. And their brains were monitored as they made the decision for each piece of paper. And what these found was that our brains look very different as hoarders when we're making decisions about other people's stuff compared to when we're making decisions about our own stuff. They looked at people who hoard, they looked at people with OCD, and they looked at people with neither. And they found that when making decisions about other people's stuff, hoarders decided to discard roughly the same amount as people with OCD did and as the control group did, the people with neither condition. But when it came to making decisions about the pieces of paper from their own homes, hoarders decided to keep a lot more of them. And what's interesting is that when these decisions were being made, different bits of the brain lit up depending on whether they were making decisions about their own things or other people's things. So there was a low activity in this particular region when deciding on other people's personal possessions, but then when deciding on your own, high activity in that same region, which is also a pattern seen in patients with anxiety disorders, this kind of hyperactivity that can then impair the decision-making process. So suddenly all these studies start to make a bit more sense. That it's not that we're bad at making decisions full stop. Like, we might feel like we are on an individual level, but the evidence shows that if you test enough of us, your average decision-making skills are roughly the same as everybody else's average decision-making skills. It's when it comes to our own things that we get tied up and panic and either make an impulsive choice or spend so long making a choice that we never get anywhere. The listener voicemail segment has a monthly theme to help you think of something to say. For September, the question for you to answer is, what's the hardest thing for you to get rid of? For some people, it's nostalgic items. For others, it's books or food or clothes. This is your opportunity to share your hardest things with us all. Have your say with your voice. If you want to record a voice message for me to potentially play on a future podcast episode, go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/voicemail and leave a message. The topic for September is the hardest thing for you to get rid of. Let us know what you're thinking at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/voicemail. I have also been reading a lot of stuff about how to improve your decision making. And surprisingly, a lot of these tactics work whether your problem with decision making is that you agonize over decisions, or whether it's that you're too impulsive, or like me, you have a bit of both. Sometimes, especially with purchases, I'm very impulsive. Whereas when trying to decide what to do with a thing, I might then get quite a bit more agonizey. Is that a word? No, it's not. So I've got 27 tactics. So if you're listening thinking my decision making is terrible, there's no way forward, even the most pessimistic person has to admit that if there are 27 options, one of them has to help a bit. So let's dive in. The first one I want to suggest is one of my favourites for any kind of complex situation. If it's a complex decision, and it is what I just call big piece of paper. That is my shortcut now to my shorthand for this particular task. You get a big piece of paper, you write in the middle of it what's going on. So that might be the item that you're struggling with, or the emotion you're struggling with around that item. And then around that word, you start writing other things that are maybe factors in why it's difficult. You can use arrows, like what's leading, A is leading to B and B is leading to C, and put things in big letters if they're very significant, and small letters if they're less significant. You can color code it. And often for me, it's a really good way, if my head is full of lots of competing thoughts and emotions, it's a really good way of working out exactly what's going on. And if there's something you're particularly struggling with, getting a big piece of paper and a pen and just getting it all out of your head and onto the paper can really help you to start to understand exactly what the problem is. The next strategy is to be aware that avoiding decision making or fearing decision making can be down to a fear of making mistakes. Essentially, if I don't make this decision, I can't make a mistake. And the common answer to fear of making mistakes is, yeah, but you can learn from your mistakes. And that is true. But I never find it comforting at the time. For me, it's not something that soothes that particular anxiety, being reminded that you do learn from mistakes, which you do. But something that's perhaps more pertinent, if you're avoiding making a decision about discarding something because you're scared of getting that decision wrong, is that failing to make that decision can also be a mistake. It's not like avoiding making the decision is default the right thing to do, or default avoiding the wrong thing. If you fail to make decision after decision after decision after decision, that's when you end up overwhelmed with clutter and belongings, because you never have made any of those decisions. So if "don't worry about making a mistake, you'll learn from it" doesn't help you, maybe consider whether avoiding the decision could be a mistake in itself. Tactic number three is to prioritize. Is this objectively a big decision or a small decision? Is this a decision that is worthy of the attention and I'm giving it and the stress I'm going through trying to work it out? There will be big decisions to make, maybe related to objects that you find really, really hard to work out what to do with. But there are also many, many, many small decisions. And if you can consciously prioritize the item or the decision as more important or less important, that can help to remind you that if it's a small decision, you can try and be quicker with it and more decisive, in order, if nothing else, to allow you the time and space to really explore your thoughts and feelings about the bigger decisions. The next item is to test it. A lot of decision making is about fear of regret. We've talked before about how hoarders anticipate regret a lot. We think, if I get rid of this, I'll really regret it. Or if I don't buy this, I'll really regret it. We have a strong anticipation of regret as a rule. And so we can avoid making decisions in order to avoid that sense of regret. So my strategy, and it might sound scary, is to test it with something small. If you're thinking, I can't get rid of that because I might regret it and that would feel awful, get rid of something that in the grand scheme of things is relatively unimportant, but that you sense you might regret. Partly to see whether you're correct in regretting it or not, but also partly to prove to yourself that even if you do have a sense of regret, that that is something you can survive. It is something you can get through and move past and move on with your life. So test out small decisions if you're scared of making the big ones. My next strategy is asking yourself more than just what if. So if you're full of what if I regret it, actually answer that question, because I often just get stuck with the what if question and never move past it. But if I carry on and say, okay, what if I do regret it? Let's look at that. I realize that for a lot of things, if I do regret it, that will be mildly unpleasant, but actually not as big a deal as I tend to fear it would be. And so what if I need it? That's another one that comes up a lot. Don't just say, what if I need it? I can't get rid of it. What if I need it? Say, what if I need it? And then answer that question. What if I need it? Well, I could buy another one for £1. Oh, that's fine then. They're easily available and I can get one in that shop 5 minutes away for £1. So it might be that you go, what if I need it? And then you answer that question and go, oh, well, if I do need it, that will be fine. Or it might be that it would be impossible to replace or really expensive to replace. And that may not be, but at least you'll know the answer to the question. Don't just stop at what if panic. And also ask yourself, what if I don't regret it? What if I get rid of this and it's fine? Because that can really calm your panicky thoughts. If you're stuck in, what if I need it? And then you go, what if I don't need it? Life gets a bit more chill, doesn't it? And your next strategy, if you're struggling with decision making, is to gather data, gather facts, but do it proportionately and not as a distraction. Essentially, the more information you have, the more equipped you will be to make a good decision. So you might Google the different options available to you. If you're unsure whether to throw something away because you don't know if it can be recycled, you can answer, can asthma inhalers be recycled, in a single Google search. If you don't know whether to get rid of something or not because it might be worth money, you can search on eBay. You can do a search specifically for completed items, so you can see ones that have actually sold and see whether it's worth your time. If you're delaying making a decision because you don't know the answer to a relatively simple question, then gather the information you need to answer that question that will really, really help you make your decision. However, this does not mean that for everything you pick up, you can spend 45 minutes Googling things vaguely related to it. That won't get you anywhere. But if that is holding you back, if not knowing a relatively simple piece of information is holding you back, then get that information as best you can. Ring the charity shop and say, do you take toasters? And then you'll know. My next strategy is to give yourself a time limit for decisions. This can help you to avoid that kind of overthinking and ruminating trap that we can get into. You do want to make a considered decision, but if every decision is so considered that it takes a week, you're going to be stuck for a really long time. And again, using the priorities that we mentioned earlier can help with this. Does this deserve a 30-second time limit, or is this one I can think about for a day, ideally while getting on with something else? Deadlines is the same kind of thing. I put these two in the same strategy category. Just set a deadline for each decision. If you're like me and you're very deadline oriented, that can really help, even if it's self-imposed, because it creates that urgency and can bypass procrastination a bit. Another great strategy when you're stuck with decision making is to limit the choices available to you. Often something that we struggle with decision making is we're overwhelmed by the possibilities. And so if you can narrow down your options, that can really, really help. So don't have 8 different bags for 8 different charity shops that each specialize in a different thing. That will get you nowhere other than a mess of indecision. It's either charity shop or bin or keep or throw. You know, it's, you can't give yourself that additional pressure by having too many choices, because the more choices you have in front of you, the more complex the decisions you have to make are. So if you can really try and simplify the options in front of you, that can help a lot. In a similar way, setting parameters for options in advance can be really helpful. Rather than making a new decision from scratch every time you pick up an item, if you've got certain rules or criteria that you have to follow, it just streamlines the process. So it might be that if food is out of date, it goes in the bin, full stop, no debate, no decision. If an item of clothing doesn't fit, it gets donated. If it's packaging, it goes in the bin regardless. If you've got that kind of criteria, those kind of rules or systems in place, you can feel less overwhelmed and you don't have to reinvent the wheel every time you pick up a tin of food that expired in 2014. You don't have to go, okay, what do I do with this one? You just go, oh, I've got a rule about this. That goes in the bin. If you can have some systems, obviously systems like that, you can't have one for every type of thing. But for those things where systems work, it really streamlines things and saves you the emotional labor of starting from the very beginning with everything. The next strategy is for if you are struggling with decisions because you're overwhelmed, and that is break your options, break what you're doing down into smaller chunks. You don't have to look at an entire pile and say, is all of that staying or is all of that going? That's impossible. I say it's impossible. I wonder if there would be something really freeing and liberating while terrifying about just looking at a pile and saying that can all go and not going through it one by one. That would be tough. But let's say that's unrealistic anyway. And you're not feeling brave enough to just condemn an entire pile without going through it. But so if you're dealing with a pile like that and you're feeling overwhelmed, or a room and you're feeling overwhelmed, just pick one thing up and start there. And then the next thing and do that and then the next thing and do that. Overwhelm is such a biggie when trying to deal with this stuff. And if we can just calm that down by simplifying, it makes it much less terrifying and more manageable. The next strategy is one of those where the name I've given it is one of those things where people give you a piece of advice and you're like, yeah, but how? So it's tolerate uncertainty, as if I can say that and you'll go, oh, okay, I'll do that then. Because if we could, we'd be doing a lot better. But the thing about tolerating uncertainty is that there will always be some uncertainty. And if we can accept that uncertainty is a given, both when sorting through stuff or acquiring stuff, and just in life, in every aspect of life, if we can accept and acknowledge that uncertainty is a given, that can help to calm us down when we're faced with it. That panic about uncertainty, if we can go, oh yeah, but it's all uncertain, rather than that being additionally terrifying, it can actually be a bit like you just surrender to it. And I think the other thing about tolerating uncertainty that meant I added it to this list, despite it being one of those things that's very difficult to just start doing, is that a lot of us aren't necessarily aware how big a role an intolerance of uncertainty can play in our struggles to make decisions. And so I wanted to include it because it gives you the opportunity to ask yourself, is that what's going on with me? Is it so hard because I'm struggling so much with the fear of uncertainty? And then if you've identified that now, that can help you to have that self-awareness and move forward with a bit more knowledge of what's going on in your brain and what's happening for you. My next strategy is to make an oversimplified decision and then gauge your response to it. When I was growing up and I had a decision to make that felt very difficult, although it was probably just something like which flavour ice cream to get, my dad would say, toss a coin, not so that if it was heads I had vanilla and if it was tails I had chocolate, but rather so I would say, okay, heads vanilla, tails chocolate. And then when I got the answer from the coin, I would gauge my reaction. So if I didn't know if I wanted vanilla or chocolate and the coin said vanilla and my reaction was, oh, then I would know that I wanted chocolate. So you can toss a coin not to give in to that degree of arbitrariness, although if that works for you, go for it, but rather toss a coin and see how you feel about the result and go with that. The next strategy is keep things in perspective, easily said, but combined with the priorities you set and the timings you've set, and answering the questions, what if I need it, what if I regret it, all of those things muddled together can help you keep each decision in perspective and can just allow you to be a little bit more flexible in your decision making. Psychological inflexibility is a term I don't think I knew before I started this podcast, but now I come across again and again and again on this topic. We get very rigid with our thinking and our approach to the world, and perspective can help us to just flex a little bit and compromise better. And another strategy to try is ask for advice. If people know your situation, you can ask them directly. If they don't know your situation, you can still ask for advice, just a bit more obliquely. Just say, I don't know whether to keep. I've got so many recipe books. How many recipe books do you keep? I wonder what's reasonable. And ask around. see what advice people have for you, or if it's something more practical. I've got a cooker that still works and I don't know, I need to get rid of it and I don't know what to do with it. Do you know where I can offload a working cooker to? People are a mine of information. You'd be surprised who knows what and who has bits of advice for who. So ask around. And another strategy is it's kind of hard to explain, but to invent, this is very much one of mine. this is not advice from anybody else, but it helps me to invent an imaginary person and ask yourself what they would do. And this imaginary person for me is somebody who is quite similar to me in their kind of values and approach to the world, but they are somebody who functions very well in the world and does not hoard and makes decisions in a more neutral, less emotional way. Now, I came up with this when I was having CBT and my therapist wasn't thrilled with what I called it, which was the technique of what would a normal person do? Because, I mean, I agree with her, the whole kind of framing some people as normal and everybody else as abnormal is a problematic one. But if you can just imagine maybe one of your friends, maybe somebody you build entirely from your imagination because you're struggling with a decision, what would they do? It can be surprisingly enlightening. You can suddenly know the answer to something you've been really, really stuck on for ages. And speaking of values, the next strategy is about considering your values when making a decision. Your values are the principles that guide you through life. It's what's important to you. Your values might be being loving and having friendships. Your values might be family-based, the importance of your family and your life. Your values might be political, environmental. They might be all kinds of things. But when making a decision, ask yourself how each option aligns with your values. So if your values are being a welcoming, loving person who nourishes your friends, then a decision that aligns with those values might be to get rid of a lot of things so that you can welcome those friends into your home and literally nourish them with tasty food that you've cooked. And also, identify your goals. Remind yourself why you are trying to make these de-hoarding decisions in the first place. What do you want to achieve? If your goal is to have a clean and tidy home, that can help you make decisions. If your goal is to be able to access your fridge, you can make decisions according to that. If your goal is to feel relaxed in your home, then make decisions according to that. If your goal is to be able to take photos within your home and put them on Instagram, then you can make decisions according to that. And the next strategy is to reframe the situation, which is kind of consciously changing your way of thinking about something. So, you know, like sometimes if you say you disagree with somebody on something, you might reframe that by thinking, okay, why does this other person think that? Let me put myself in their shoes and see if I can see where they're coming from. And this is similar, really. It's about stepping out of your own shoes and therefore the emotional charge of making this decision and trying to kind of interpret the situation through a different framing, through a different lens. It can be really, really helpful. And another strategy is to think about the long-term and the medium-term consequences. Don't just focus on the immediate consequences of your decision. Think about how these decisions will affect you in the long run. So if you are deciding whether to keep some kitchen chairs think in the short term, it will be stressful to find a new home for them. But in the medium term, it will clear up space that will allow me to sort and tidy more areas. And in the long term, it will contribute to me having a lovely home that I feel confident and comfortable in. And that helps to take you out of the immediate emotion of the decision and think, yeah, but what do I actually want? My next strategy is, once you've made a decision, try to just put that decision to bed. Make a decision and stick to it, and try and not agonize over decisions you've already made. You make your decision, you stick to it, and then try not to second guess yourself. Try not to have a post-mortem analyzing whether it was exactly precise and correct or not. It adds agony to an already agonizing process, and that is honestly the last thing you need. And then my next strategy is to use decision-making tools. So I'm talking about things like, the simplest is just a list of pros and cons. This is another thing that my dad would have me do if I couldn't make a decision. Piece of paper, pros on the left, cons on the right. What are the good things about making this decision? What are the bad things? And if you want to be really simple, you can just go with the one that has more. But more likely, there'll be some pros and cons that are more important than others. But getting it down on paper is a good way of trying to be a bit more objective in your decision making and try and removing some of that emotion. A very similar thing is looking at costs and benefits. It's if I buy this food mixer, there's a literal cost of how much it will cost me. There is the cost of that some space taken up in the kitchen. The benefits are it looks great and I'll be able to make all these cakes and weigh things up, which is more important, which is less important to you. And brainstorming is another good decision-making tool. Write every thought down in your head. Jot it all down. Don't kind of self-censor. And once you get it out of your head and onto a piece of paper or into a notes app on your phone or something like that, it's like you can breathe out and go, okay, what's actually going on? What do I need? Which words on that piece of paper are actually relevant to this decision, and what is just incidental and unimportant but was taking space up in my mind? My next strategy is looking at emotional intelligence when you're making a decision. Emotional intelligence is being able to recognize the emotions you're feeling, that kind of self-awareness, and manage your emotions reasonably effectively. Self-awareness, self-regulation, empathy, social skills are all parts of emotional intelligence. And the more you can nurture those skills in yourself, the more you can trust that you don't have to remove emotion from a situation to make a decision, but you can keep it under control, you can keep it measured. You can use that emotion along with rationality and logic and data to inform your decisions without being controlled by the emotion. That is a long-term skill, and it's one that people work on their whole lives. But anything you can do to nurture emotional intelligence is something that will help you in a wide range of areas of your life, but will definitely help you with decision making. And the next one is to trust your instincts. Sometimes you get a gut feeling and it's right. It's if you have a strong intuition about something, it's worth at least listening to what it's telling you. And this is hard when you're somebody who struggles with decision making and knows that maybe your emotions are sometimes out of control. You don't know what's genuine gut instinct to listen to and what is an emotional, maybe fear reaction. But if you're cultivating emotional intelligence and if you're gaining in self-awareness, you can start to trust your instincts and your gut reactions more and know when that should play into a decision and when it can be put aside. Now, another strategy to improve your decision making is to practice your decision making. It doesn't all have to be big, hard decisions. Start with small, easy ones and gradually work your way up to the more significant ones. If maybe you always buy the same cheese because it saves you making a decision, maybe next time you're in the supermarket, have a proper look at the cheeses and see whether that's the one you really want or whether another one catches your eye. Start with I know cheese is significant, but start with something relatively insignificant like that. And the more you do it, first of all, you'll gain in the skill, but also the more you make decisions and prove to yourself that nothing terrible happens, and the more you make decisions that go well, the more you can start to have trust and faith in your own ability to do it. And the second from last strategy is to learn from past decisions. Because when you've practiced decision making, you're gaining in skill and you can get to bigger decisions more easily. You can also use what you learn from that to inform your future decisions, but also to inform yourself on what helps. If you look at past decisions you've made, you can ask yourself, what helped me make that? That was a really hard decision. How did I get to the point where I could make a decision on that? Or you can go, I never did make a decision on that other thing. What strategies did I try there? And were they just not for me, or did I not maybe approach them right? And so you can learn from the practice of making decisions, and you can learn about which decisions you make that you feel super confident with and which you maybe feel a bit uncomfortable with and how that works. But also important, do remember that you have hoarding disorder, and so your past reactions aren't always going to be 100% reliable or helpful. If you've given up something before and regretted it, that doesn't mean, therefore, I must learn from that and never get rid of anything again. What it might mean is, at that point, I wasn't ready, and at this point, I'm more ready, so I can try again. And the final, you will be glad to know, strategy to improve your decision making is to cultivate compassion for yourself, most of all. Cultivating compassion can make you more empathetic to other people. It can help you make more ethical decisions and more balanced choices. And if you're considering compassion for yourself, and especially compassion for those you live with, if you live with other people, the compassionate decision, even if it's a hard one, can be the right one, because the compassionate decision can be to get rid of at least some stuff so that you have some space in your life for life. I make this podcast because I think it's important. I started it as an outlet for myself, but it's become much more than that. And I hear from people all the time about how listening to me talk about my experience and interview specialists and experts is helping them. Hearing those stories makes the time and cost absolutely worth it. But if you want to help to ensure that the future of the podcast is sustainable, you can donate to help with costs. To send a one-off or recurring donation, just go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/donate. Thank you.
1-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So my top tip this week is from the very lovely women at the Declutter Hub podcast. So shout out to the Declutter Hub and do listen to the episode where I interviewed Leslie from the Declutter Hub on this podcast. I will link to their podcast and that episode and all the links I've mentioned in the show notes at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. But have a listen to their advice for what to do when you're trying to declutter and you come across something unexpected.
It can be a really big roadblock when you're decluttering, when you come across an item like that that you weren't expecting, or is not in the place you thought it was going to be. And the cupboard that you were going to do felt like a safe cupboard to do. And suddenly you get confronted with something. It's like, oh, wow. But the thing is, like Leslie said, either take a break and go, okay, I need to step back from this item, or go, this is a really hard item. I'm going to put it to the side, and I might put it. It's probably, a lot of times, it's probably a sentimental item, most I would say, and put it in a sentimental box to deal with later and go, right, that is just not for me for this moment. I'm going to put it to the side and I'm going to revisit that when I'm doing my sentimental items much, much later in my decluttering journey. Now I'm going to keep focused on this cupboard or wardrobe or shelf that I was doing.
So that's something to bear in mind. Okay, thank you for listening and I will speak to you next time. Thank you for listening to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder podcast. You can find more online at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. You can find me on Twitter at That Hoarder and on Facebook at Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder. To find out more about how you can support the podcast and the overall project, go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/support and do subscribe to the podcast to make sure you don't miss any future episodes. There may be links in this podcast that earn me money. This doesn't come at any extra cost to you if you ever make a purchase through the links, and it helps to support the future of the podcast.
Now on Broadway, An Enemy of the People is a New York Times critic's pick. Jeremy Strong is one of the great actors of his generation, hails the Chicago Tribune in a performance the Wall Street Journal praises as powerfully affecting and bitterly funny. Michael Imperioli sets off sparks, cheers the Hollywood Reporter. Victoria Pedretti is luminous, raves variety. From director Sam Gold and playwright Amy Herzog, An Enemy of the People is urgent, electrifying, and haunting, declares USA Today. An Enemy of the People on Broadway through June 16th only.
This is the summer to expand your horizons. It's time to explore. But before you set foot out the door, set foot in the ultimate lightweight, super packable travel shoes from Allbirds. Find your perfect pair at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.